As I said, I'm Pete, and I'm the 10-minute speaker. After my share, there'll be a 10-minute break before the main speaker. After the break, I'll introduce the main speaker, and the secretary will close the meeting after her. So this is my part. I'm Pete. I'm an alcoholic. I almost didn't even come today. I know the main speaker, so I had to come because I've heard her share before, and I like her. It's good. It's a good share. It's a good story. I didn't expect this, but I was told not to turn people down. You know, do the what I suggested to me. So believe me, public speaking ain't my thing. But I'll make it through it. I'm sure. I don't know. I'm not one of these people that say I was drinking since I was 2 and a half or anything like that. But I know I drank when I was a teenager. It's part of my story. I did a lot of other things when I was a teenager. I never got to. My dad drank a lot. He's an alcoholic, baby. My mom, an alcoholic, definitely. Never drank with any one of them. Or I never drank with my dad after I was 21. He quit drinking, so maybe he's not an alcoholic. But by the time I was 21, he was done with it. But I drank with him a lot when I was a teenager because that was just how it was. He didn't care. I didn't know I had a problem with drinking. I was about, I don't know, my story bounces around a lot, but when I was about 25 years old, I got a job. I got a job in law enforcement, and I quit doing all the drugs and all the other dumb stuff that I was doing, probably at about 23, so I could get this job. And I got the job, and I was like, you know, I didn't have a problem quitting anything I ever did, except drinking. But I didn't know I had a problem stopping drinking, because I never tried to. It's like legal, right? So it's all good. I'm going to drink my beer, do what I want. I'm a grown-up now. I don't do drugs. I'm not a dummy. And life is going good, you know? In that line of work, I don't know. Divorce, suicide, alcoholism are big. And two out of three I've done. And I don't want to do the third one. So I drank. It got worse and worse as I mean, from 25 to, I think I was 30. 99, I got a DUI. It was 0.08, you know, nothing glamorous. It was 07 on the side of the road. They took me downtown, and it was an accelerated back. They got me for an 08. The guy actually said, "Here you go, and you can do it." And I was like, "F you." I was mad, dude. Dude just thought it was funny because he got me, you know. But I didn't think much of it. I mean, I had like two beers. I mean, it didn't come to me until later in the program that I had a DUI coming a million times, and they just didn't catch me when I was drunk. The only reason they caught me is because I wasn't looking out, because I didn't think I was drunk, because I wasn't drinking that night, right? I had an 08 and I wasn't drinking. But they told me, I went to counseling classes, all this stuff, and AA, got a court card, got my invite here. I came to AA, got my court card signed, sat in, there was no back of the room, but I sat in the room and sat and judged and watched people for about 8 months. For my ex at the time, and, you know, just because, well, maybe I got a problem, I don't know, I didn't drink. So for 8 months, I didn't drink. For about 2 months, I went to meetings. And like I said, I judged everybody. You know, this guy was, you know, that's a woman. That guy's black. That guy's homeless. This guy's that. I was very prideful, and I couldn't relate to anybody. I was divisive with everybody. There's nothing. Nobody liked me there. There's just, I couldn't get it. After 8 months, you know, I easily convinced myself I wasn't alcoholic, because you don't quit drinking for 8 months if you are. So I started drinking, and it was fun. I ain't gonna lie. Drinking was fun for a lot of time in my life. And I was 30 years old, and I drank for about another 11 years or 12 years. And for about the last two of that, it wasn't fun. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't want to be drunk. It was a daily routine that I woke up and said, "God, what did I do? Why, you know, man, I had too much. I need to stop." And then, you know, 2 hours later, it was like, you know what? You know, I'm going to have a beer, but I mean, I could do that every day. And I mean, every day. If I was at work, whatever. You know, if I go to work and, hey, if I kill somebody at work, hey, maybe they won't drug test me. I don't know. But I'm drinking. That was my life. But it did. It consumed me. One night I got drunk and, I got drunk like any other night, and I got into it, got into an argument with my girlfriend, and I woke up in the county jail. And, you know, it's an embarrassing story, man. So there's nothing prideful about it. They cased me with attempted murder and assault with a firearm and a bunch of other things. They were going to give me 16 to life. And obviously, I didn't get that. It was about 5 years ago. But at the end of the day, you know, that happened on a Tuesday. I mean, that's embarrassing. I got arrested for attempted murder on a Tuesday night at 7. I thought that would happen to me on a Friday or something at a bar, but never a Tuesday. And it's like I woke up, you know, in the morning, and I'm just like the night before. Okay, when are you going to kick me out? When are you going to kick me out? You know, like basically, don't you know who I think I am? And yeah, we know who you are. You know, we've seen you before. And I didn't realize they'd seen me before. I just didn't know who the hell I was. They did. And, you know, for the grace of God, they didn't kick me out. You know, they kept me there for a while. And so I went to court, and I took a plea bargain for 3 years. So so I'm not a cop anymore. You know what I mean? Now I'm an inmate. For 3 years, I had to go to prison and try to figure that out. And so, you know what? I survived. I got there. One night it was snowing. I was up at Hatch View. It was cold as hell. And they locked the door on my building. So I'm like, damn. And there was a big old long line. And I walked there. I said, what are you guys doing? So it was AA meeting. And I was like, well, I can do that for an hour, man. Then I get back to my building. So I went over there and I got my little free coffee. And I went to AA. And you know what? I did that for that year. You know, I went every Friday night, and they had NA every Wednesday night, because that's basically all the state offered, was one meeting for each a week. But I went and the program didn't change, and I don't think it's changed much in all the years that it's been around, but I changed a lot. And the biggest thing that changed was my attitude. And it was funny, it was good. I was stripped of a lot of my pride when it happened. I was stripped of everything that I owned physically, you know. And you know, I didn't own my kids, but I lost my kids. I lost my home, my cars, I had a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff that kept me so better than everybody in my mind that I couldn't figure this out. And you know, I actually told somebody. Somebody was talking about, you know, character defects, and I said, I don't know. I say I'm prideful, maybe, you know, and he's like, yeah. I said, yeah, I mean, there's so much worse. And he laughed at me. He's like, really? There's less than pride? And I go, you know, yeah, pride's nothing. And he goes, okay, you know. And so I got schooled a little bit, you know, and I found out how bad that is, you know. And I try to stay right size now, and just that's what I've learned in here. And it's funny that I don't know, with all the meetings I went to there, when I got out, you know, my big decision was, you know, okay, I had a couple friends left, believe it or not, out of the thousands I thought I had two. And they were going to have a bonfire, you know. We're going to have a bonfire. You're going to get effed up tonight, Pete. And I'm like, yeah, I'll come over, you know. I say, I come over, I was living with them. I mean, damn, I was homeless, right? So I'll come out. So so I went out to this bonfire, and, you know, I drank a soda. You know, actually, no, his wife made me a pot of coffee. I made a pot of coffee, and they just like, what the hell's wrong with you? And I'll be honest, that was the tough decision. The tough decision wasn't when I quit drinking, basically, 19 months prior to that. That's how much I was locked up for. The tough decision is when I came out, was I going to go back to it or not? And I really had it in my head, you know, I had a bad night. You know what I mean? It was a freaking bad night. You know, what's the chance that that shit could happen again? You know, I've drank for 25 years and nothing like that's happened. And I had to be honest with myself, you know, the chances of that happening again are probably zero if I don't get drunk. You know, and I said that, you know, I'll never go back to prison if I don't get drunk. I can guarantee that. But I can't guarantee that I won't get drunk. And that's the hard part. Because I'm a bad person when I drink. I mean, I'm not known to be around. You know, it's hit and miss. I could be the best person to be around. Everybody loves me in my mind. And then when I'm crossed or I think I'm crossed or something bad happens or I'm not happy, man, I do some bad things. And I've hurt people in my life. I'm pretty much everybody that was in my life I hurt, including me. But, you know, I'm not so worried about me. I can fix that. All these other people, they didn't deserve it. It's like I said, it's not a glamorous story. It's not a great story, but my fear was not knowing who I was. For 25 years, man, I was just Pete, the guy that drank and partied and did all this stupid stuff. And you know what? I wasn't above the law, but I thought a lot of myself. I really did, a whole lot. And when I went to jail, I found out, what was I? I had a job that I thought made me somebody. And then I realized, you know what, I'm just a damn drunk. You know, I'm nobody to be around. I treat people like crap all the time. And, you know, I need to change that. What to change it into, I don't know. I never had that example. I don't, I got, you know, four uncles. Two of them committed suicide. One of them died of cirrhosis. One of them's dying of cirrhosis, but he's drunk daily. So, you know, my male role models, they're lacking. But, you know, I found other ones in the program, people that I look to say, man, this dude, you know, when I came in and dudes were like, yeah, you know, they're celebrating, you know, 75 years of sobriety or some crap. And I'm like, I was like, God, dude, you know, there's no effing way I'll be here in 75 years, dude. If I don't figure it out, I'll go get drunk. This is stupid. And then, you know, I figured some things out. My attitude changed, you know, and I realized that, you know, all I thought, the only reason I thought that was a bad thing is because I thought it was a bad thing. And now I don't. Now I think, hey, why don't I think that's a good thing? You know, what's wrong with the fellowship here? You know, I know a lot of people in this program now that would, you know, let's just start with the less of the phone if I call, you know. I got, like I said, 1,000 friends out there that, you know, I don't know if they're dead or not because I haven't contacted them. They haven't contacted me. I made a lot of amends. You know, I came back and I made the amends I could. You know, it says if it'll hurt them, we shouldn't. And there's also the courts have told me, hey, how about you don't go make amends to that person because we'll fucking lock you up again. And so I haven't. But as far as the living amends, you know, I try to do my best, and that's all I can do. I can't do everything. I can do my best. And but I tell you, with the attitude and the things that I've learned in here, you know, the things that helped me are the one I already touched on. They said, you know, do whatever's suggested. You know, if people come up and they volunteer you to speak or chair or whatever, and you're like, all right, you know, that's going to make me uncomfortable. You know what? I've never grown in comfort. So that's a good thing. You know, when I'm uncomfortable, hey, I'll get something from it. And that's a good thing. And the other one is, I listen for people for similarities because I know when I got here, as divisive as I was or divisive or however, I judged everybody. And I today can find something in everybody that I can relate to or that reflects what I've done. Or I can, you know, I'm not judging. I'm just saying I can look at people and go, yeah, I get that. I hear people share. We do a lot of different meetings and we go to different places to get that. And I'm like, that's good stuff. And I can do that when I hear people now. Not, dude, how stupid are you? You did it again? You know, and it's just, that's how I was. And I got, you know, five and a half years of sobriety, and I've learned that that's the wrong way to be, you know. When I came back to Hanford, I went to a Nooner meeting in Hanford and met a few people. One guy that I had met in 1999, you know, who's one of those guys that's got 75 years of sobriety and ain't figured it out yet. And he's a good dude, you know. He and I are very different. I won't say we're very similar. We're not. But when he shares, I get something from him every time because, you know, he keeps it real, you know. And at first, you know, some of these guys, I thought it was crosstalk. I'd share and they'd share about something I shared about. And I'd be like, really? You know, and that's my old self coming out like, do you want to talk about this? Let's go talk about this. Don't do that shit in front of people. Let's go outside. And wow, you know, how bad is that? You know, and that, and I have to realize that that ego and that pride is just, it's ridiculous. I'm nobody, you know. It's these people that are doing this, that have got a good life, I need to learn from that. And so, you know, the open-mindedness, I guess, is the best thing that I have learned in this program. I guess that's all I got. All I can say is, I mean, I don't know if there's any newcomers here. I mean, one guy stood up, but you know, I was told a long time ago, you know, stick around, you know, don't leave before the miracle happens. And it is. This has changed my life. My life is great. You know, I can't, shit, if I complain about something, I'll tell you what, by 5 o'clock tonight, that complaint's gone. I mean, there's just, it's just life. You know, life has bad days and good days, but I don't dwell on them. I don't drink them away. And you know, I got feelings today, and they're pretty damn good. And when they're bad, that's okay. Like I said, you know, I've learned that I can grow from that stuff. So that's all I got for you. And thanks for asking me to share. I appreciate it. Okay, now we take a 10-minute break for the main speaker. Thanks for letting me be a service. I'd like to introduce our main speaker, Anita from Lemoore.
I'm not as tall as Pete, so I got to bring this down. Hi, my name's Anita. I'm an alcoholic. I am very grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd just like to thank the people who put this on, the breakfast meeting. It's always fun to be here. It is a pleasure to be a service and come up here and talk about whatever it is I'm going to talk about. One of the things that I thought about on the way coming up, I said, hey, I don't want to listen to any special music. I just want to listen to some rock and roll, clear my head, and say whatever comes out of my mouth. So even I may surprise myself. I want to thank the guys who keep blowing the horns. That's pretty cool. Angel and Jason. Yeah, right on. I met them the other night at a speaker meeting, and that's what it takes. You keep going to meetings, you keep coming back, and something happens. A miracle happens, you know, the miracle happens, and that's what we talk about around here. You keep coming back, and don't leave until that miracle happens. You too have a chance of living just a wonderful life that this program has given me and many other. I didn't know where I was going to start off with or what I'm going to talk about. Like I said, I just try to let it flow a little and then start to have some fun with it. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't having any more fun. I was drinking because the alcohol was taking me. My allergy, what I've learned, it's an allergy, and the craving kicks in, and that took me everywhere. I could not stop drinking once I put it in my system. I didn't know that at the time, and neither did my family, so I was beat up quite a bit by my parents, by my friends. Nobody wanted to drink with me no more because the insanity, the things that I was doing during my drinking while I was drunk is not the insanity. You get anybody drunk and they do pretty stupid stuff, especially when you can't remember it. but it seemed pretty bizarre to them. I mean, I'm jumping out of cars while they're going. I'm chasing people down with no shoes, chasing you down, trying to get whatever's yours, claiming it's mine. You know, it's just really, really bizarre behavior. I started drinking when I was about 8 years old. That was my first drink. I didn't continue drinking throughout my childhood, but I was introduced to alcohol. I did step into my childhood drinking. In fact, this area, we used to go fishing down at Success Lake. I was with my dad, and we'd pick up my uncles, and all my uncles were alcoholics. And so my dad would buy a couple of gallons of wine and would come up to the lake, and it'd always be freezing. It was weather like this, and I'd be freezing, and to me it just seemed it was a lot colder back then, and I was freezing, and I couldn't go out with my dad, so he told me to stay. So my uncles told him, hey, let her stay with me, and they built a fire, and he said, let her have a little bit of wine. So I remember drinking a little bit of wine. The thing about my uncles then being winos, they were the type of winos like I was talking about, chasing people down, falling out of cars, jumping out of cars. So they were pretty beat up and been in many wrecks. People used to beat them up a lot too. So they were always skinned up, and they had the real bad skin, and they had the real rough voices. And being as small as I was afraid of them. But once I took those two shots of wine, I wasn't afraid of them anymore. You know, and that continued throughout that year. I didn't drink anymore. I've shared this story before that I was abused growing up. I was abused by my mother's mother. And I learned a lot about that, and probably the reason why I was abused by her. Well, I don't know why I was abused, but I can understand why she was angry. She was taken away from her family at the age of 4 and was put in a boarding school. A lot of Native Americans were put in boarding schools back then. And that's some of the history that they don't teach about Native Americans that we complain about a lot. All my grandparents were taken away from their families, and my grandmother was one of them. And some of the cruelty that went inside of these homes, my grandma didn't show a lot of affection. She wasn't able to give a lot of hugs, but she somehow was very cruel and mean to me, and I never knew why. So I was always with my parents always sent me to my mom and to my other grandparent, my Grandma Rosie, who was very kind and just loving and always told me stories and always took care of me. And just a good lady. I mean, I used to go with her up into the mountains, up into the Tule River mountains, or over at the Kings River, and would dig these roots up, and she used them to make beautiful baskets, and she made beautiful patterns with some of the roots that we would dig up. It gave such a color that it made different colors for the different patterns of her basket. And she passed that along to me. I don't know the names of these roots, but I guarantee I know which ones they are when I see them, because I always, when I do see them, I think, hey, that was pretty cool. So I know I have that in me. And I asked her one time, I said, Graham, how can you never teach me how to make these baskets? And she said, because you're not a basket weaver, you're a gatherer. And I took that with a lot of pride. I loved my grandmother very much growing up. I had an uncle that lived with her as well, and he drank. My grandmother would go up into the mountains. He also suffered from diabetes. And so we'd go up into the mountains and would dig this root up. And when he'd get real sick with his diabetes, she'd give it to him and he'd bring him back. And then he'd do really good. He was a binge drinker. He didn't drink on a daily basis, but when he binged, he'd be gone for 2-3 weeks. And then so she'd bring him home. I mean, he'd come home and she'd go up and get these roots and come back and fix him up. Living with my grandmother, I had a pretty good life with this grandmother, but I was terrified of the other side of my family. And by the time I was 10 years old, I stopped listening to my grandmother. I started running around with the other kids on the reservation. It just seemed it was just fun, you know. It was fun to go hang out. And I didn't get into a lot of trouble with my grandmother because she wasn't abusive. She wasn't mean. This grandmother that I'm talking about, my grandmother Rosie, she wasn't abusive or mean. So I kind of told her, I mean, if she told me to come home and I didn't come home, she'd be mad at me, and all the punishment I got was she didn't talk to me the next morning. But I still got my breakfast. She still made my, cleaned the house, I mean, made my bed and stuff like that. She just wasn't mean. So I got to do pretty much whatever I wanted to do. Well, it started to have effect on me in school, and my grades were going down. So I remember her telling me that we're going to go visit my mom and dad, and at this time they were living up in Northern California. So they drove me up there and they dropped me off, and when I say I was 10 years old running with the other Indian kids on the reservation, we weren't being good Indian kids just running around on the reservation. We were getting into trouble. We were waiting for the winos to pass out or drunk enough to take their wine, you know. So she ended up, this caught up with me at the age of 10. So she took me up to Northern California, and we stayed there for about a week. And when they started getting ready to come home, I need my water. When they got ready to come home, she said, you're going to stay here with your mom and dad. And I remember, thank you. I remember feeling very angry and very hurt because I felt the only person who ever loved me had just abandoned me. Turned out that was probably the best year I ever had with my mom and dad. I have siblings who, I had, two brothers and three sisters, they were never abused or treated bad by my other grandma. In fact, I would watch my grandmother, when they'd come in, she was always loving, caring, and would just love on them, you know, just, love them very much. So I never understood why it was just me. And I don't think I ever really got that answer, and it really doesn't matter anymore. What happened was after I moved up with my siblings and my family, well, my siblings, they're starting to get into things. And we're about the age of 12, and we're actually hitchhiking and going places, and we're starting to smoke cigarettes and have other adults buy our drinks for us, you know. So, and we're not drinking beer, we're drinking whiskey. This is what works. And we're just kind of running around, and we only lived there. I only lived there with them for about a year, so we ended up moving back to the same reservation that I just left, and down on my dad's reservation. And I'm about 13, 14 years old, and man, everybody was drinking. And when my mom and dad would have parties at their house, I was hoping my sister would be here today because I like talking about our behavior when we were teenagers or just turning teenagers. Because what we would do is we'd wait for the party. Wait for my mom and dad to get drunk, wait for everybody to get drunk, hopefully they don't drink up all the booze, and then we drink up the rest, you know. And then we started getting brave by taking off with their car, and we'd get away with that for a while, and during the summertime it was okay. Sometimes my mom would say, honey, did you take off last night? Because I thought we had a full tank of gas, you know. But what started happening with that, again, it started to catch up because now we're getting the car stuck somewhere or there's a flat tire. So now we're getting caught, you know. But this kind of went on for a long time until I finally just left, you know. I'm in high school. In the eighth grade. And I remember all the other girls were all talking about boys and whatnot sitting underneath the tree. And they're watching all the boys and talking about them. Some are already dating, and I'm like, it's just boring. I don't fit in with this conversation, but I didn't fit in with the boys either. Even though I played a lot of sports and I was pretty fast and I was pretty good at what I played, but when I drank, I fit in. I fit in everywhere. I just had a great time doing what I was doing. And you know, in high school, everybody's pairing up, and I kind of got paired up with this person, and all through high school, everybody seen us as a pair. I ended up having two kids from this person. Absolutely hated this guy. Could not stand him, and I still don't like him today. I talk about At the end of my drinking, I was vicious. I say that I was the beast without a tail. I was literally terrified of myself because I never knew what I was going to do. I never knew how I was going to wake up in the morning. I didn't know if I was going to be stabbed. I didn't know if I was going to wake up beat up. I didn't know if I was going to wake up in a town. I didn't know where I was at. And all this in between, from there to the, from high school, all my drinking just continued to progress and the behavior progressed. And you know, I mean, I'm just a mess. I'm living in this house by myself. This guy that I was hooked up with, that I was paired up with, because he wasn't a choice. He really wasn't. I wish it was that way, but it wasn't. It was, again, everybody just kind of paired up with each other. I was living in this house, and I was about 17 years old. He was already in prison. His mom was in prison and his dad was in prison. And I'm living in this house, and it's got cement floors. It's got the block walls with the swamp cooler. However, nothing worked because there was no electricity, and there was no wood to start a fire. And I just kind of lived there. It was just a hole in the wall. And I drank through that. I just drank whiskey or whatever I could find, you know. I would work off and on at this bingo parlor that the tribe had built. And it was crazy because when I'd go into work, every night they'd want to go out and party. And every night, there was a part of me that says, you know what, you need to slow down. You need to, you know, you're just tired. I'm just... I can't do this every night. I'm burned out. And I'm 18 years old, and I just want to go home and go to sleep. You know, and I didn't own a car, but my friend Pam did. And we'd all get in the car, and I would literally look down at my feet in the back of this car and tell myself and beg my feet to get out and take me home. Let's just go home. And literally wanted to go, but I just couldn't. Next thing you know, I'm back at the bar and I'm back out doing my thing, you know. And this went on night after night after night. I partied in a lot of bars before I turned 21. I think my first bar I ever partied at, I was 13 years old, and it was actually right on the outskirts of Porterville. Because my family, I have family here in, on the Tule River Reservation as well. My mom's a Tule River Indian, and my dad's a Tachiyokut from the Lemoore tribe. And I was working at this bingo parlor, and every time I went in, I had a hangover. Every night I went in, and before going in, sometimes I'd drink before I went in, and I had this buddy who owned this little Beetle, and so we'd go to the store really quick, get some alcohol, because the outskirts of Stratford and Lemoore area, they'd sell to anybody. So we'd get something to drink, and then we'd ride around for a while, and then we'd go into work, and sometimes I was either semi-intoxicated, and if we didn't do that, I was hanging over pretty bad. And I didn't have a lot of money I probably had enough to buy me new clothes, but I never had new clothes, you know. So I'd wear what I had the same day and go back into work. And, you know, everybody was getting kind of tired of me because I wasn't coming in on time. I try to leave as early as I could. I'm not a good worker. And I was learning all the schemes and scams to steal. And I didn't look at it as stealing. I looked at it as tips. You know, we used to sell, and somebody may remember this, I don't know, but we used to sell these things, they were called pull tabs. And what you do is you pull the back and they're like lottery tickets, and it shows all kinds of lines if you win of what, and then it's and then you look at the front and it tell, and you look at what the front says, and you go by numbers of what you won. And sometimes if you couldn't read it and you were wrong and you thought it was only $20 and I knew it was $250, I'd just pay you the $20 and keep the $200, right? And again, like I said, these thing, kind of things went on for years. And I would also, if there was like the last, down to the last box of these pull tabs and we knew that there was still a big winner in there, I'm now taking some of these pull tabs into the bathroom trying to win. Pulling, and if I pulled it, then I just paid whatever, how much the amount was that I pulled, and then take the rest home, you know. And again, it was just some of the things that I did that I thought was, I didn't really think it was stealing. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. The other thing was, is I kept getting fired from this place. I couldn't reach my quota, you know, because they told us we had to have a quota. I'm goofing off all the time. I'm showing up late. I'm coming in drunk. I just can't keep nothing together, and so they'll fire me, you know. And now, poor me, what am I going to do, you know? And I still managed to drink. I still managed to find alcohol. I had kind of a side job going because I loved to break horses because I was good at breaking horses, and there was people who would pay me to break their horses, and I loved to ride horses, so that I had an acre lot where I would keep the horses and I'd feed them, and I took good care of them at that time while I was still able to. And again, but with my drinking progressing and stuff, I remember my dad would wake me up and say, "Hey, get your ass up and get over there and go catch that damn horse. He's been running around for three days now with the saddle on him," you know. So I would go catch the horse, take the saddle off, and but that's what I did. And I don't know if anybody ever got a ticket for riding the horse drunk, but I did. I used to ride out to that, again, one of those little towns way in the outskirts, and buy what I could, you know, and it was usually a little bottle of whiskey or a little bottle of wine, whatever I had enough for, and I'd ride the horse back, you know, and it'd be late at night, it'd be dark, and this just, these kind of things just kind of continued. Back with this guy that I had gotten hooked up with, people didn't like us around each other, because when I say that there was a lot of anger going on, if he could be sitting at a party doing his own thing, just drinking, no matter, just being all cool, and all of a sudden I just come up with a bottle, just hit him right upside the head. And so it got to the part where even my siblings would tell me, you know, when you come, if you come over, he's here, you don't start your shit, you know. But it was the same for him too, because it got to that. He would say the same thing to me. He says, "You know what? Don't start your shit tonight." Or I could be somewhere out partying, and it always turned into a big fight. I got beat up a lot while I was out there. Not only by him, by a lot of people. I didn't win a lot of fights. I was always, my mom used to get really afraid for me. She used to say, "You know, one of these days I'm going to find you dead. I'm gonna hear about it." And I just kind of think, "Oh, mommy's being silly." And I had a roommate. I started dealing cards, and I had a roommate that dealt cards with me, and he ended up leaving because of the same thing. He said, "You drink too much." He said, "Mija, you're gonna die. This stuff is gonna kill you." I don't think anybody wanted nothing to do with me because of those reasons. They thought they were gonna find me dead somewhere, you know, but nobody knew how I was gonna act either. Nobody knew what type of behavior I was gonna be in, you know. So I relate to stuff like that when I hear people talk about it. I didn't know how I was gonna act. So at this time now I have one kid. I have a daughter. And I have to say that when I was pregnant with her, I did not want to have her. I was hoping for all the worst possible things that can ever happen. I didn't know about abortion. I probably would have had anything like that if it was around. I don't even know if it was around. But I did not want to have her. So I lived dangerously and I lived wild. She, when she was born, yesterday was her birthday. She's 32 years old now. And then I had another daughter. Both these kids, I always left them. I would leave them. And again, when I'm talking about my drinking, I didn't do it because I wanted to. I didn't do it because I disliked them. I mean, I didn't like them, but I didn't like hate them, you know. And so I would leave them just to go have a drink down at my buddy's house. It was only two houses down. It's only 10 o'clock. They're asleep, so everything's fine. You know, they're okay. Everything's okay. And I tell myself that I'll be right back. And that right back never happened. And mornings turned to days, you know, because, again, this is a progressive disease. And that's what started happening. And next thing you know, 3 days would go by and I'd go. And, you know, it was terrifying to wake up and not know where your kids are. Terrifying not to know where you last left them. Not knowing. I had three babysitters. Then I got down to one because nobody wanted to watch them because I don't come back when I say I am. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. When I'm saying I'm going to be right back, I really meant I'm going to be right back. But something behind me would say, you're not going to be right back. There's no way. I put something into my body and it takes me. You know, when I put alcohol into my body, there was no stopping me. And I went everywhere and done everything that I not possibly wanted to do, because obviously I didn't want to do any of those things. It just happened. My daughter, last night we got to go celebrate her birthday last night. She was 4 years old when I got sober. My other daughter was 2 years old. And she says she vaguely remembers my drinking. And that's a good thing. My youngest daughter doesn't remember anything. So, you know, when I think about some of the stuff that I put them through, you know, I want to stress on that it, as a person, it wasn't me as a person. It was my alcohol that said, it didn't say anything. It just took me. The minute I put it into my system, it took me. You know, when we talk about the insanity, we're not talking about the insanity of the dumb behavior we have or the things that we do. It's the insanity of picking up that first drink if you were sober. You know, Jim's story in the Big Book talks about it. Got a guy who everything was going along fine and thought that he could put some whiskey in his milk. Everything would be fine on a full stomach. And, you know, that was that's the obsession kicking back in. And when that happened, see, I didn't know any of that stuff when I came here. I didn't know I had an obsession to drink. I didn't know that I had an allergy, and they explained the allergy that once it was in my body, the manifestation is the craving. I didn't know those things. So that started to make sense to me. See, my family didn't know that either. They didn't know, they didn't understand this disease. All they knew is I drank a lot and they wish I would stop. My mom had threatened me to lock me up and take away my kids. And at first that sounded like a pretty good idea. And then my ego kicked in and said, wait a minute, she ain't taking nothing. So I fought her about going into this program. She said, you're either going to go or I'm going to take your kids away from you and I'm going to have you committed. And she probably could have convinced somebody to come pick me up from some of the things I'm doing. I mean, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I literally had no shoes. And I like saying that story because I ran around on the reservation up to that point, up to that moment, with no shoes for a long time. And I had no job and didn't even know where my kids were. And my mom said, you're going. And I said, no, I'm not. And then my excuse was, I don't have no shoes. And she said, well, you're going anyway. And my sister, who drank a lot with me, says, I'll give you my shoes. I was upset with her. I got to say, I was upset with her. Every now and then I joke with her about that still, you know. Do you remember when you gave me those shoes? And today I thank her, though, because I wouldn't have came, you know. And I remember coming into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a Thursday night meeting up here in Springville. And I've seen everybody, and there's still some faces that I recognize and that I remember, you know. Some ain't here no more. Herman was one of them. Herman would always come up to me at the meeting, and I don't know if he did it every time. It just seems like every time. But he would come up and give me some candy, and he'd say, "Are you doing all right?" And before I could tell him no, he'd say, "Do you got a roof over your head tonight? Do you got a couple of dollars in your pocket?" He goes, "You're doing better than all those alcoholics out there still practicing." He'd say it something like that, you know. And I just kind of hung out. I had no plans of sticking around more than 3 days. All I needed was enough time for my mom to get off my back, you know. I'd figure this stuff out somehow. And what ended up happening was I kept coming back and I kept going to meetings. I ended up getting a sponsor. And it wasn't because I really wanted this program that I got a sponsor. Everybody else seemed to be doing it. You know, everybody else seemed to, they kept saying, "Do it, do it, do it." And so I did, you know, and I got ready to leave this treatment center, and they said, "When you get home, just go to a lot of meetings." I remember Herman telling me that. "You go to a lot of meetings." And I said, "I know, but I like these meetings up here." And he says, "Well, if you go home and you go to all these meetings," he said, "the people there are pretty much gonna be the same way, and you're gonna like it there too. And if you don't, then you can come back up here." You know, so when I got home, that's what I started doing. That very night I went home to, back home to the, house that I left, the holes in the wall, no electricity, no gas, floors all torn up, no carpet, no linoleum, no, there's nothing in this house. I don't even think I had cups in the cabinets. I don't even know if there's cabinet doors. You know, I mean, the house was just a mess, and so was I, but I went back to that house and I made it a home. Through Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I said I might, I was thinking last night, I think I might feel this today, only because yesterday was my daughter's birthday, and I know how much I put her through. I know, and even though she doesn't, know how much I put her through, I know how much I put those kids through. I know how much I put my grandmother through. You know, the grandmother that raised me, now I'm in my drinking, and I'm just begging her for her car. I'm begging her for her last $10. I'm promising I'm going to clean her yard. I'm promising I'm going to mow the lawn. I'm promising I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to do that. And could you give me $10 for it, and I'll do it tomorrow. You know, and that tomorrow never came. I just took from that poor grandma. And I was such a nuisance. She would tell me no so many times, and I'd just sit there and just wait and wait and wait. And then I'm driving away in her car when she gives me the keys, and I'm thinking, my grandma loves me. You know? It was the fact that she was just tired of me. Take it. Get out of my hair now. You know? Just get rid of me. And I share this a lot because I know who I am. I know I'm a taker. I know I'm just a... I'm going to take everything I can. I'm going to abuse you as much as possibly can. And I ended up selling my grandma's car in the bar. You know, I sold my horse in a bar too. That one I was upset about because the horse was mine. The car wasn't, you know, everything I did was just horrible. So I get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and people just, when my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous, that first meeting on that Thursday night, I swear, I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. But when I walked into that room, I heard everybody giggling and laughing and just talking with one another. I swore, I really thought that you people were still drinking and you guys were going to teach me how to drink like that. That's what it was all about. And it had nothing to do with that. It was learning how to live, giving yourself to God, finding a God, you know, and that's what ended up happening. I ended up moving, after I left here, I moved back down to Lemoore, and my sponsor here in Springville told me, "Hey, you're going to have to get a sponsor over there, somebody who you can be close to." And I knew that because I was getting ready to deal with some things. You just can't stay sober and keep coming back, and all this pain is starting to come up. All these feelings are starting to happen for me. I don't know what they are, and I don't know what I'm going to deal with. I don't know, but I knew, and I wanted to stay sober at this point. I had to give it a shot. And so I get this sponsor. And That's what I do. I already knew I was alcoholic. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that my life was unmanageable. I knew there was a God in this world. I knew that. I didn't trust in him. I didn't believe in him. I still had the frame of mind that he was a unloving, hateful boogeyman to me. And he must have been, because look at where I came from. I came from two different reservations with all this poverty. I have a family that drinks. I have a grandmother who doesn't like me. I have a mom and dad who gave me away. I mean, and don't get me wrong, I went to church. They sent me to St. Anne's Catholic Church when I was 6 years old. I only lasted there probably 2 weeks. When I was done with God, I was done with God. I wanted no more to do with him. And I would have to, they would send us to catechism. They would send us to, depending on what family, what side of the family I was on, because some were Christian and some were Catholic. So I went to different types of church, but I only went because they sometimes had punch and cookies. You know, that was the only influence of God that I, or church that I had. So when I got, when I knew that there was nowhere else to go, that there was nothing else, this is the end of the road for me, or I go back living the life that I had lived, I had to make a decision to turn my will over to God. I said I was going to give this a real shot. And I was willing to, I made that decision. And I remember I was crying. I was telling Alan, who was sponsoring me at the time, I said, Alan, how am I going to know who God is? I said, how do I turn my will over to somebody that I, something that I see or what I have in my head that has, I felt only tortured me and wanted nothing from me and wanted to see me suffer. And she said, Anita, you need to find your, get rid of that God. She says, get that one out of your head and start over. She said, find something of your own conception of a God that you could work on and build on. She says, and she did tell me, she says, you don't have to know anything of God. And then she turned around, she said, is there anything in your life that you remembered that you had a faith in? And I told her, I said, you know, I had a real good, I mean, I said, I don't know if this is faith. I said, but I used to be able to jump rocks. I mean, I don't care how slippery they were. I knew I wasn't going to slip and fall. I can get on any horse and I knew I was not going to go off. Me and that horse was going to go down together, but it was not going to throw me off. And I said, is that a type of faith? And she says, that's something to work on. You can build on that. And then what ended up happening is I remembered when I was 10 years old, my grandmother took me to this, it was all these old women. It was during a celebration of our tribe, and I didn't know what it was at the time because I was very little. Well, I was about 10 maybe, but she took me to this celebration, and there was like 20 something old Indian women who were singing and drumming, and all the people who were drinking, I mean, there was some drinking going on, but they were, it was like, today I looked at it as a form of respect. Nobody came into that part of the circle, and they were all singing and drumming, and I asked my grandma, what were they doing? And she said they were praying and they were giving thanks. And I was like, wow. So that was actually my first idea of a God that I might be able to work with. And from there, you know, I told my, I remember when my sponsor told me to think about it, I remember going home and thinking about it. And that's what I started to, and that's what came to mind. And from that day forward, I continued to build on that. Today I have a God in my life, and you know, after doing step three, making my decision to turn my life and my will over to a care of God that I understood, I still knew nothing of him. It was the next, it was step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, 9 that taught me about my God. I remember after doing that, I could do a fourth step. When I was up in Three Rivers, I was standing there and I just started bawling, because I knew somehow that now that I made that decision and I knew I didn't have to know him, I can depend on this. For some reason, I just knew that. And I went off to do my fourth step. And, you know, I wasn't that honest, so I didn't do a great fourth step. I didn't do the most honest fourth step. And there was things that I forgot about that I didn't put in. There was things that weren't revealed yet, so I did another fourth step. And, you know, and it continues working that way. I continue working on myself. I continue doing step six. I continue doing step seven. Sometimes I'm not even realizing I'm having to do another step. You know, jealousy pops up. I got to get rid of that. Fear pops up. I got to get rid of that. Those are the steps. You know, I have to look at what's causing this. I mean, it's a step. I have to do it. I'm willing to do these things today because I like the life that I get to live. Today, I can't even tell you what a great life I have today. Even when I'm going through the worst of times, it doesn't stop me from having fun. It doesn't continue to worry me throughout the day. My whole house just got flooded. Only two rooms in my house, my back bedroom and my kitchen. Everything had to be pulled up. I mean, I got the water crawled up the walls. I mean, it stayed on all night and I didn't know about it. I slept right through it. That's how good I sleep today. They came in and they were... this company came in and they sucked up all the water. And they started to, and they said, hey, look, everything on this is damaged. We need to get rid of it. So they pulled it all out and got rid of it, you know. And I had all these fans. I still do. All these fans in my house. It's so loud. It's very uncomfortable. It's annoying. But honestly, that's not even a problem. It really isn't. I have people saying how sorry, that's sad. You know, I hope everything's... And I'm glad I'm getting those things because that just means they care. But it's really not that big of a deal to me. It really isn't. The first thing I thought of was, I'm glad they pulled all that stuff up because I do want to put tile in. And that just saved me some money because I don't have to hire a guy to pull up that carpet. You know? It's the way I have to look at it. And now, if I had no money and I couldn't take care of it, then I probably just have to learn to live with that way until I can. You know, and I hope I can live that way, and I hope I never have to never have any money to fix stuff. But, you know, that, I tell you, it's just a really nice feeling to know that I have a God in my life, that I can change my attitude, my outlook, everything that this book talks about. You know, I've never been able to... tell you everything in this book. I don't know it word for word, but I know it in my heart, and I know it what it has done for me. You know, I want to share these two things that when I came into my meeting here, when I was coming to meetings in Springville, there was a few things that I do remember, and I do want to share this because I was having blackouts. I mean, these were some major blackouts that I was having. When I say blackout, I'm gone for 3 days. Because I know and I literally would try to catch myself. I'd say, okay, I know it's Monday today. I know it's Monday. And I'm thinking, I'll go out and I'll go drink. And then I really believe it's Tuesday the next morning. And it's not. It's now Friday, or it's coming up, you know. I mean, I'm missing 3-4 days out of my life. And I'm really, at first I thought people were playing jokes on me. I thought they were playing some silly jokes on me on some of the things that they were telling me that I was doing in my blackouts. What came to mind was me is, I got it, man. I have a brain tumor and I'm going to die soon, so I'm just going to keep drinking. Because nothing explained these blackouts, but I knew I was having them. Like, I would go into this bar, it was called the Pub. And I'd come out of the frickin' 3-7-Eleven bathroom on... But I remember I just went into that club. I just went into the Pub bathroom, and now I'm coming out of the 3-7-Eleven or just arriving. I lost so much time there, and I don't know what the hell's going on. I was confused. And I remember sometimes I'd be getting... I would be in this... I don't know why I've always ended up... I always somehow ended up in the Kmart parking lot. And this happened a few times. Where I have the door open and this... My right foot is still in, and my left foot is hanging out, and I don't know if I was getting in or if I'm getting out. I'm confused, and that's why I said I just diagnosed myself. Because nobody, you know, and I'm scared to talk about it. I am terrified to talk about it, but people don't seem too terrified to tell me about it when they see me doing the things I'm doing. You know, I don't know what year it is. I don't know what day it is. I'm a mess. So when I came here to this meeting, this guy comes in. He's got a polo. He seems like he's pretty smart. He sits in there and he talks about, and this is the way I heard it. And I wasn't sure if this is the way I heard it, and it was meant for me to hear it this way. And I since got to talk to him about it, but came into a meeting and he said that he had a blackout. He had a few drinks after dinner, come home, drinking wine or whatever. And anyway, one night he just has a blackout and he shows up in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I'm not that smart. But what the way he described it that night, I identified what I just had. I've been having blackouts. Man, I was so grateful I wasn't going to die. I was so grateful I wasn't going to die. You know, it's just things like that would happen for me. Another thing that happened was I remember, and it was actually Cheryl who said this, and I'm going to share this. It was Marcy, his mom had just passed away. And this always stuck with me, too. And I remember Cheryl, as Marcy walked in, the meeting had already been started, and Cheryl said something about Marcy coming in, and his mom had just died, and here's a guy who probably has all right to go out and get drunk, but here he is sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a little bit later in that meeting, Marcy shared, and this is again, I don't know if this is what he said, but this is the way I heard it. And again, since I've gotten to talk to him too, he said, there's no reason for anybody, for me to be in, let me think if I say this right. There's no reason for anyone not to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's if you have a death in the family and that be yourself. And that had stuck with me for a long time. Because when Cheryl heard it, I was like, yeah, that guy needs to be out drinking. You know, I mean, that's what I'd be doing. In fact, in my early recovery, I had a friend, and when I say early, I was like 2 months sober. I had a cousin that is a distant cousin. He's like a third cousin. The only time I ever met him was somebody told me he was my cousin. And I sat by him in the bus when we were going down, dropping us off at Vandalia. Anyway, years later, he got in a car wreck and he got decapitated. I'm in a treatment center and I'm thinking, oh, my poor cousin died. I should, you know, I'm going to go get drunk. I didn't even know the guy, you know. And then another time happened where a friend of mine, her mother had passed away. And I'm all gloomed about it because I want to be sent home from work. I don't want to be at work. But it wasn't because her mother had passed away, but that was my excuse for you to send me home. You know, and I remember my supervisor calls me and says, I hear you having problem. And I said, yeah, I just don't feel good. He goes, what's the problem? I said, well, my friend's mom passed away. He goes, oh, you guys were real close? And, you know, I get to learn about myself. I'm learning who I am. I'm learning what a conniving little manipulator I am. And the only way that I'm going to ever change my personality and my character is if I start putting the footwork in. And that was to do these steps, you know, looking at my character defects. You know, and I was confused for a long time. I mean, what's a character defect? What's a shortcoming? What's self? You know, I didn't realize it was all the same. It's just worded different. And here I am thinking, now I can't figure this stuff out. You know, I don't know what I'm doing here. So it got real simple after that. It got real simple because now I know that all I got to do is pray about it. And the answer will come if my own house is in order. And the answer, it will come if I truly want it. If I truly want the right answer, God will answer that. At least my God has always done for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. And since I've been here, I've made a lot of good friends. I have a handful of friends. I can't stay sober on fellowship alone. You have to work this program. I've seen people come in and sit here and have a good time in the fellowship and not do a step. Won't work the steps. They could tell you about them, but they won't work the steps. And you wonder why they're all doom and gloom. You know, I'd get invited to go somewhere with a group of people and say, no, I don't want to go. You know, at first I could blame my self-esteem. But they'd say, hey, you got to go. You got to start making yourself do these things. And I say, no, I'm not going to go. Well, why not? Because I'm not going to have any fun. And oh, you know that? And I'm like, no, well, I won't. You know, and then I'd try to prove it to them. But then I'd get to the party and there'd be somebody there who would come up, would start talking. Next thing you know, I got a new friend. I had a pretty good time. You know, I don't want to go to that restaurant. Well, why not? You've ate there before? No. I want to go back to the one that I'm comfortable with. You know, that Perko's that they had down here in Porterville? I think it's on Henderson. That's the only place I want to go. I don't want to go anywhere else, you know. But that, again, that's where I was. If people used to tell me, Anita, are you happy? And I'm like, yeah, I think so. I feel like I'm pretty happy. And man, I sure didn't look happy. I did not look happy at all. I wasn't smiling. I wasn't participating. I'm not doing anything. I'm just sitting there. This is doom, you know. But the bottom line is I just didn't know how to be happy. I didn't know nothing about myself. I hated me. You know, I didn't like, and God was, when I thought about my God, He punished me to put me who I am. Every time I got in a wreck, I thought that was Him punishing me. But then I always had the last laugh because I thought even He couldn't take me. You know, I just, that's my thinking. That was everything that I, so having to get rid of those ideas and those thoughts and put in a new ideas, you know, change my attitude, change my way of thinking. I know I had a personality change. I do know that. My personality started to change where I was starting to smile a little bit more. I was starting to say hello. I'm starting to show up. I'm starting to do things. And my life started to get a little bit better, you know, and I started doing, taking on the rest of the steps. Telling God He could have all of me, good and bad, you know, step 7. And it wasn't, I realized too that I didn't have to know step 7. I didn't have to know step 6. What I had to know was all I had to do was get rid of these character defects. But I didn't have to, when I say didn't know, I mean I didn't have to do them perfect. I didn't have to do anything perfect around here. I worked on not lying. I worked on telling the truth. You know, I remember my boss said, it's just me and him, we're the only two that worked in this building. And he comes in, he says, hey, the VCR's broke. Did you break it? I said, no. He goes, are you sure? And I said, no, I didn't break it. I knew I broke it. We're the only two. You know? But I'm not going to tell him. I just put it back in the box, put it in the shelf, and hopefully, you know, he never uses it. And so, you know, he calls me in. And unfortunately, he had 23 years in this fellowship at the time. And he talks to me about honesty and about trust. You know, and he said, you know, we got to keep these things going. He's real tidy, too. He always kept everything clean. But so I'm learning how to do these things. I'm learning how to clean my house. I'm learning how to work these steps. I'm learning how to go to meetings. And you know what? I started to have fun. I was starting to have fun. I mean, I remember when I had nothing in the house and all I have is gas electricity now. I remember the first thing I bought was a stereo when I was able to save money because I'm not using it for anything. I mean, I'm paying all my bills and I have a little bit of money. And I went down and bought me a stereo. And things started to get fun because now I'm cleaning my house. You know, I mean, all I have to dust my stereo, but at least I'm cleaning it. But I'm dancing. And I remember I would put on candles, you know, and light the candle. And it was just little things started to happen. I mean, I have enough to fix that hole in the wall over there. And I'm going to buy something over here to cover that hole, you know, and the house started looking a little bit better for me, you know. And before you knew it, I was able to do things. I remember when I bought my first washer and dryer, you know, it's like no more carrying bags, no more going to the laundromat. It was neat. You know, I think I had about six, maybe 5-6 years in this program, and my tribe what they started doing was after they finished paying off the building, they started giving back to the community. A third went back to the community, and so much went back into development. And I remember calling Cheryl at the time, and I'm crying. I don't know if you remember this, but I was crying because I didn't know what to do. I was learning how to work. I'm learning how to work for my money. I'm learning how to get up in the morning. So when my tribe gave me a check that was more than what I pull home, I was scared. I come from poverty. I don't know how to handle this. And she says, put it in the bank and do something with it. Save it. Go travel. You know, I'm sorry. I'm from a reservation. I don't travel. No. I stay right here wishing I could. But I'm learning to be free, and I'm learning to get out there, and I'm learning to do things. And that, you know, the more I put into my program, the more I get back. I try my best to be the most honest person I can to me. Not in this meeting, not here right now talking to you guys, but out there when I'm working, in my relationships, in my job, you know, in my home. How I treat my grandchildren, how I treat my daughter, how I treat my relationship, how I treat my friends, how I treat my mother. You know, that is the test. That, it says it, that's the acid test. I must do a pretty good job because everybody invites me places. You know, I do. I get invited to a lot of places. New Year's Eve, I had so many places to go. You know, that it's just so neat to know that I can wake up in the morning and I'm not hanging over. And it's just a good feeling. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I had to do was work these steps. It's all I had to do was work these steps, keep coming back, stick with the fellowship. And I do all those things. I reach out, you know. I don't do anything alone. If there's something troubling me, if I'm going through a problem, I call somebody. I shouldn't say somebody. I know who I call. I call the people. I call that person who I know I trust in. And I talk to them about the situation that I'm in. You know, and it's a miracle what this program does. I tell on me when it's my fault, when I'm at fault. And I clear it up when I'm at fault. I don't hold on to any of this. And that's why I think I sleep so well. You know, it's pretty neat to go to bed in the morning, do my prayers, wake up in the morning. The first thing I have on my mind is my God, my creator. And not my flood in my house. I'm serious. It's just the way it goes for me today. My daughter is still practicing. She's out there and she's doing her thing. And she's a mess. You know, and she's not the first person on my mind. She isn't. I know that if she's lucky, and I keep praying for her, and I hope you do too. Her name is Rose. God's going to take care of her. Well, that's another thing. When I came in here, Alan, who was sponsoring me at the time, would tell me, Anita, they're your kids, but you got to let them go. Let them be kids, but you're not. They're given to you. Those are God's kids. They're given to you to take care of. And if anything, because I was always worried about them getting. Okay, here's the other thing. I was worried about them going out playing and getting ran over. I ran over my daughter twice, literally. But I was worried about somebody else running over them, you know. I've just learned to do this way. It's so much freedom. I'm not responsible to anybody but to myself, to my God, and spreading the message. And you know, I mean, I am responsible to go into work. I do have to get up in the morning and go to work. You know, I call, sometimes I share with Nora, sometimes I tell my sponsor or whoever else, those people who I really trust. I don't really care for my bosses. They don't make that, their decision making isn't that great. And, you know, it's tough. It's really tough. But here's the deal, man. I don't criticize them in front. I mean, I don't try to belittle them. I don't show them that I'm angry. I sit down and try to show them a positive way. And even if it doesn't, even if they still decide to do what they're doing, I just go with it and do whatever it is they're telling me to do. I mean, because they still are my bosses and I still got to do it. And I don't do it negatively. You know, before I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it this way now. And it's not going to be that great of a job when I get it done, you know. And I said I used to get fired a lot. I got fired a lot from the same job. Because, again, I was a mess. And they had every right to fire me. I'm not a good worker. I remember I was involved with the law a lot. And again, it was always over misdemeanors, but they turned into bigger misdemeanors and bigger fines and failures to appear. Why go to court when you knew they were only going to give you a fine, you know? So now they're looking for me. And I remember the first time they came into my job and they found me. I was embarrassed. And they hauled me away right there because they had a warrant for my arrest right at work. And then about a couple of months later, they came into my job. The sheriff's department came into the job, and I was thinking, oh my God, now I'm hiding behind things. You know, I'm really nervous because I'm thinking they're here for me. They were there because there was a bomb threat. I was so grateful it wasn't for me, you know. Heck with that bomb threat, you know. I was grateful they weren't there for me, but they probably should have been, you know. But they didn't want nothing to do with me anymore. Again, when I say I was a nuisance, I was a nuisance. I would call them for every fight that me and this guy that they put together. His name was Ray, but I mean, we fought a lot. I mean, viciously, brutally. When I say we fought a lot, I've been left out in the field. Beat up where I've been found, you know. We were pretty brutal, and I mean, I literally tried to kill him one night when he was passed out, and I had all the plan, and I followed through with the plan, but he didn't die. It wasn't in God's plans. He did end up in the hospital. He thought his cousin did it to him, so I let him believe that. You know, but the doctor said he was very lucky. The doctor said that he was very lucky. Anyway, that's just the brutal life that I lived. You know, it's what I know. It was the hopeless futility of life. You know, I like that part in the book because I understood that. And I understood that you people were going to give me a message because you've been where I've been. Some of the stories that I started hearing around here, I can identify with. And you know, when I said that I was grateful to know that I wasn't going to die because I didn't have a brain tumor, I remember the first time I realized that I was an alcoholic. I had that same cheer that I wasn't going to die. But now I'm left to have with you guys, and that wasn't too fun either, but it's a blessing to be here. It's a blessing to be in Springville, California with you guys, spending my morning talking about God, talking about recovery, sharing my experience, strength, and hope. Again, I've never had it so good. You know that job I kept getting fired from? Today I'm the director of human resources. You know, it's a big deal to me. And I know today I don't fire people, they fire themselves. And I know that because I was doing that to me. I could have been a good worker. I tell you, my first year I went back to work there when I'm still dealing cars. I want to share this really quick. I was, I've been fired all the time, and I went in drunk a lot, and I'd done a lot of stupid things when I worked there, and I had no right to even have to get another chance. But when I got sober and I had to go back to work there, and I couldn't steal from there, and I couldn't lie from there, and I had to stay there a whole 8 hours and give good work because that's what I was told I was supposed to do. My whole first year I did that, and they gave me my evaluation. I wanted a gold star for doing what I should have been doing, showing up. I wanted the gold star for being there at 8 o'clock, right on time. You know, I wanted a gold star for staying there the whole 8 hours. I wanted the gold star for not taking that or cheating the company. You know, not stealing that pull tab money. I was only doing what I was supposed to be doing. Anyway, I think I ended up getting like a 2% raise, which I wasn't that happy about, but it was better than what I was getting before. You know. Anyway, I am an alcoholic, and thank you for having me here.